You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. As military service personnel return to life in the United States after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, many are discovering that they have little in common with civilians. That's according to a recent series in the Los Angeles Times that tracks a growing divide between civilian and military life in America and finds that now more than ever, the two groups are living very separate realities.
We're joined now by LA Times reporter David Cloud, one of the reporters on that series. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, looking at this series, it looks like you're painting a picture of two Americas. One, civilian, people who don't really think much about what goes on in the military life, and the other, families and people whose lives center almost totally on the military. Can you spell out how that has worked out?
Well, you know, we wanted, after a decade of war or longer of war, we wanted to kind of take a look at the relationship between the military and society, and larger society. And we found sort of a paradox, if you will. On one hand, you know, the military has more support than it's almost ever than it's had almost in, you know, in decades, certainly since the Vietnam War. On the other hand, this tiny group of volunteers who make up our armed forces now endure sort of sacrifices, and their lives have been upended by the last decade of war in ways that most people can't even imagine.
Almost a separate warrior class is a phrase that comes up in your reporting.
Yeah, and some of them see themselves, some in the military see themselves that way. They're obviously highly competent, highly professional force that's been asked to do a lot of difficult things for the last decade. And if you talk to them, as I have and as my colleagues have, many of them express, you know, some feelings of alienation from society as a whole, coming home and feeling that people don't know what they went through, feeling like they don't know how to fit into a society that isn't really aware of the sacrifices they've made, and also just finding a place in that society that doesn't revolve around the military is difficult for many of them.
And this isn't just a feelings of separation. If you're in the military, especially long term, life is very much separated from civilian life. Can you talk about how people in the military really are living in different parts of the country, different places than the rest of us?
Yeah, that's true. You know, there are increasingly there are parts of the country that are heavily military, that have large bases. You know, that in one case, you know, a person we talked to characterizes, you know, sort of the country's largest gated communities. These are, because of concerns about terrorism, et cetera, highly defended places that you need special passes to get into. People inside those communities, you know, live, you know, lives that are almost separate from, you know, the lives of people on the outside. I don't want to overstate this too much because there are plenty of communities where the military is integrated. But, you know, for example, in a place like Fayetteville, North Carolina, there's a big base there. And the community is very dependent on the military. So there are pockets of military presence around the country now, but in large cities and in other parts of the country, there's, you know, running into the military is the exception rather than the rule. So there's a kind of physical separation that has gone on too. On the other hand, I want to make clear, you know, the military comes from our society. It's not as if there's some alien presence here or something. And there are National Guard units in communities all around the country that, you know, offer up their citizens and their citizens volunteer and then go back to their jobs. So it's not a black and white picture. It's more a sort of shade of gray here.
But for the active duty military people you talk to, in many cases, they are coming from a smaller pool of that society as a whole, often people with generations of military service behind them.
That's true. It's a sort of a self-selected group, particularly among officers. You find that sons and daughters of serving officers, serving active duty officers. They grow up on military bases. They accompany their parents, some of whom are two officer families, you know, on overseas deployments in some cases, you know, to places like Germany, certainly not to Iraq or Afghanistan. But they get into this lifestyle of the military, and naturally, as any kids do, they want to, in many cases, they follow their parents into that life. And, you know, so it becomes a sort of self-selecting kind of class.
Talking to David Cloud with the LA Times, talking about a series he worked on looking at a divide between civilians and the military in the United States. One of the most striking things that I saw in your reporting, David, talking to a World War II veteran, 90 years old, saying, back in my day, you never thanked somebody for your service because everybody served, just about, or most people served. It was really common. He sees things very different nowadays. It hasn't always been this way, has it?
Right. I mean, the big divide that we're talking about here is obviously doing away with the draft after Vietnam. I mean, that was a conscious decision by the military, you know, and by civilian leaders for that matter. They decided, you know, that we needed a sort of standing army, something the U.S. historically avoided having, a professional army to kind of play the role that the country needed the military to play. And after the kind of tumultuous period of Vietnam, nobody wanted to go through the kinds of protests and the kind of heavy drug use, for that matter, heavy alienation that many Vietnam veterans felt, both fighting in Vietnam in a war that many saw as a lost cause, and also coming home and being treated as mistreated, if you will, when they came home. So there was a clear policy choice to do away with the draft, come up with an all-volunteer force. The result of that, though, and it's been very successful, it should be said, the result of that, though, is that you know, this group has been created that is separate from the larger society.
Another result seems to be an increasing reliance on National Guard units in active combat duty. And as part of this series, you followed a group from Michigan that had served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and then what their lives were like coming home. Can you tell us some about that?
Sure. I mean, the idea was that the Guard, at least in popular conception, is supposed to be this kind of force that straddles the civilian and military world. They're supposed to be able to go off to war, do their duty, come back and pick up their civilian lives. What I found, I've been reporting on the military for a long time, but what I found was actually quite interesting, and that was that the length of time that people have been going off on deployments since 9/11 has really changed that myth in a considerable way. Young men in particular, you know, joined the Guard after high school and got on what they like to call a sort of deployment cycle, where they would go to Iraq, do a 9-month, year-long tour, what have you, come home, they'd have plenty of money in their pockets, they wouldn't get and didn't have a civilian job, so they would spend, you know, the next 9 months, you know, just decompressing, if you will. Then they go on another deployment, and it just sort of goes from there. And now we're at the end of this long period, and many of them, you know, don't have careers. They're 26, 30 years old. Many of them some of them haven't been to college. So they're wondering sort of how do I sort of reacclimate myself to civilian life?
Yeah, so we end up with a situation where those people in the National Guard or the regular military have no experience with civilian life as they try to enter it, and they're meeting civilians who have no understanding, no direct connection to their experience in active service.
Right. And in the case of the story you were talking about, I focused on several members of this unit from Michigan who'd been in a pretty bad attack, all of whom had been injured in one way or another, four in particular, and sort of tried to focus on what it was like for them to come back, you know. And it's been frankly quite difficult for these four. Some have adapted and moved on. In most cases, you know, the older soldiers who have a wife or have a spouse, you know, and have a certain level of stability, maybe had a career beforehand, are able to readapt. It's not easy for them either, but for the younger soldiers or those who have been badly injured, it's a much, much more difficult process.
We're talking to David Cloud, reporter for the LA Times, about the gap between civilian and military life here in the United States.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think U.S. civilians are too insulated from the impact of wars? Have you served in the military? And do you feel the separation from civilian life? Do you think it's a problem? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking to LA Times reporter David Cloud right now about his recent reporting on a growing divide between U.S. civilians and members of the military.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you noticed this separation between regular society, civilian society, and the recent wars? How does this affect us as a nation? Have you served in the military? Have you noticed this separation? Civilians don't get what you've gone through. Maybe you have a hard time adjusting back into civilian life. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line in Madison. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that I have deployed from both active duty and from a reserve status, and it was much harder to deploy from a reserve status going from your civilian job to the workup and deployment and then your post-deployment era. However, my deployment from active duty was pre-9/11, and my deployments after 9/11 were much more appreciated by my employer and the civilians around me. So that made it much easier. However, I do also want to say that our culture and society does not prepare young people for adulthood as it did. Now, I've been in the service for 20 years, and when I first went in, a lot of my compatriots stepped into leadership roles within, a year and a half of being in. And now it takes a year and a half to get 18, 20-year-olds prepared to even think about stepping up to a leadership role. So our culture needs to mature young people faster and not give them so many entitlements.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. He brought up a lot there, David. One point he made is that he felt the appreciation from the civilians around him, including his employers. In your reporting, David, you talked to some people in the military who thought a lot of the thanks for your service kind of statements were lip service, not sincere. What kind of things were you hearing?
I mean, you do hear that. It's not uncommon for people. This divide is unlike the divide that existed in the country during Vietnam. It's not a hostile divide. Both sides kind of in some ways like this the way it is. There is plenty of support for the military, and some people in the military feel that it can be insincere, the sort of thank you for your service. Others like that and feel appreciated by that. I don't make a judgment about whether that standing up at ball games and applauding the troops and gestures that like that are, some, as I say, some appreciate it, some don't. The question that I have is whether there's a deeper issue here in terms of whether we're creating one group of people who sacrifice and the rest and the larger mass of people who don't have to sacrifice, put their lives literally on the line, and whether that is an issue for the country, going forward. Can a democracy really function that way long term? I think it's a real issue.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Howard in St. Francis. Howard, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm currently in the Army Reserve, and I'm a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I have no problem with doing deployments. I have no problem with serving. I have no problem with putting myself in harm's way because I do that freely and knowing the consequences. But what bothers me is that during the past 13 and a half years, numerous politicians have said, we're a country at war. We're not a country at war. We're a country at the mall. The United States Army is at war. The United States Marine Corps is at war. Not America. America has kind of abdicated their responsibility. And I say this because people think they're putting a yellow sticker on their SUV that's supporting the troops. What I want people to know or support the troops is, one, read about the issues, two, vote, actually vote, and three, make yourself smart about what's going on around the world with American foreign policy, because most Americans are quite ignorant of the fact that it's not the Army or the military that goes overseas. It's the duly elected civilian officials that institute foreign policy, and the military then implements that policy. So those are my views, and I'm happy to take any comments you have off the air.
Howard, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a point that comes up in your reporting, David, the concern that with this large civilian population that isn't in the military, isn't sending their kids in the military, maybe doesn't know anybody who's deployed in many cases, doesn't have, as they say, skin in the game when it comes to American foreign policy decisions to send troops to other countries.
Yeah, that is one issue that really kind of is interesting to me, is that the declining number of politicians who've served in the military, and obviously they're responsible for sending troops into battle, and in years past, most politicians, because of the draft and the ethic of service was stronger, had served in the military. And it raises an issue, which is, you know, to me anyway, I don't have an answer to it, but the issue in some way to me is, you know, is it easier to go to war now because we have this professional military and let these sort of wars sort of proceed year after year with no resolution? And, you know, would that have happened in the old days when we had a draft and when everyone, almost everyone, had skin in the game? There probably would have been more of a demand for a resolution than there is today. I don't know. I find that an interesting question.
And did anyone you talked to in the course of reporting, David, say we should go back to the good old days of having a draft, or were people happy with this volunteer military concept?
You know, very few people say that sort of thing. On either side, and to me, it's another example of how this is kind of a situation that neither side particularly objects to. The Pentagon certainly never wants to go back to a draft. They like an all volunteer force. It provides a motivated force. It's a ready force. They don't have to take people who don't want to be there and turn them into soldiers and airmen, et cetera. And certainly, there's very little support for it among civilians too. So I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Talking to David Cloud, reporter for the LA Times, about his reporting on a gap, a social divide, not necessarily an unfriendly one, between civilian America and the small percentage of people who serve actively in the military or have been deployed via the National Guard to places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Victor in West Allis. Victor, hi.
Well, hi. I'm a Vietnam era veteran from 62 to 65 and served on the fleet. Here's one thing a lot of people don't realize. There's a lot of mental strain that when a personnel goes overseas and something happens domestically at home, that he or she cannot run right away and try to solve it. They have to do it far, far away. In my case, in the 60s, was all we had the snail mail, and a lot of people don't understand either. When my mom got sick, I was told, Vic, we can't ship you out because we don't exist on where you are. And that puts a lot of mental strain on you. So they said, well, notify through the Red Cross how your mother's doing. But till then, you're on your own.
Victor, thank you so much for sharing that. And David, you talk about this from both ends. Military families trying to keep tabs on what their deployed spouse is doing overseas and what condition they're in. And, you know, parents overseas trying to catch their kids' graduation on the internet. Talk about the stress on both sides there, please.
Yeah, there's a lot of stress. And you know, in a strange way, there's, as the caller alluded to, in the old days, there was just because of the technological situation, it was much harder to stay in touch other than through occasional letters. Whereas today, the Army and the Pentagon goes out of their way to make it possible for troops deployed to stay in much closer contact with their families. That is a double-edged sword, though. It puts families are much more aware of what's going on day to day. I mean, I think there's obviously some benefits to that. But it also, you know, it creates tensions, concerns, understandable concerns among spouses, and you know, it's never going to feel exactly the same if you're in Iraq and your son is or daughter is graduating from high school and you're not there, even if you can, you know, see it, you know, on video or something like that. So there are always those kinds of tensions, as the caller said. But there's also a kind of, to me, this situation kind of reinforces the separation of the military. You know, most people aren't going through that, whereas these families are trying to adapt and figure out a way to stay in touch with these constant deployments that their spouses and parents have gone through.
When you talk about in your piece, you know, headlines that we might see in the newspaper the next day about an explosion affecting troops might more or less shut down some of these military communities as they're trying to figure out, who is it? Is it my husband? Is it my neighbors? My wife? This affects this military side of the population much more directly.
It does. And you know, in this case of the Michigan unit that I focused on, you know, I mean, the wives of several of these soldiers who were injured were in touch with their injured husbands within hours of the incident. I'm sure that was comforting to some extent. On the other hand, it also you know, intensified their worries. And in the old days, they wouldn't have known for days, and it would have taken, you know, the Pentagon would have had to notify them. In this case, they're aware within hours or minutes.
David, thanks so much for reporting, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was LA Times reporter David Cloud talking to us about the growing divide between U.S. civilians and people serving in the military.